Welcome to the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My guest this week is Todd May, who is the head of philosophy at the University of Kent. Todd tells us about being born in California, what it was like to grow up in an environment that was a hotbed of republicanism. He tells us about his love of rock climbing, how Heidegger's Being and Time had a particular influence on him. We learn about the time that he worked as a claims adjuster. Windsurfing is something that Todd has done since moving to Whitstable. He talks about that. We learn about the influence of breakdancing and skate punk and wrestling when he was younger. His apprehension of Los Angeles in the light of the Rodney King riots is something that Todd talks about. He tells us what it means to be shaped by opposition, why that is a particular phrase that's meaningful for him. We learn about the different political sensibilities between the UK and the US. We learn how Todd responds when people ask him whether he's a theist or an atheist. We also find out whether he would prefer to be an academic or a rock climber, and why, as Heidegger would say, looking back is Todd's way of looking forward. So join me for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. My guest this week is Dr. Todd May. Well, it's an absolute pleasure this morning to have Todd May with me from the philosophy department. Now, we've known each other for years, haven't we?
Yes, that's right.
Because you were here, obviously, in a different incarnation.
PhD student in religious studies.
Yeah. And then we obviously worked together. Actually taught as well. There were some modules, weren't there, where we did some teaching.
Yeah, what is religion? That was the first stage one module. Yeah.
And that was really quite funny because it was in my early days here, and because it was a team taught module, we all sat in each other's classes in many cases. And so there was almost like all this peer reviewing going on, because I think you might have been doing some of the seminars and I was doing some of the lectures. So
that's right.
So it was a great way to get to meet colleagues.
Yeah, it is. And it's a great way to find out what kind of connections you have intellectually with the approaches they take. So
yeah. And obviously you're now teaching in philosophy. But give me a bit of background then in terms of, well, indeed how you ended up here at Kent, but in terms of going as far back as you can, sort of where and when you were born.
Right. So where I was born in La Jolla, California, which is very close to San Diego. And unfortunately, I didn't grow up there. My parents moved to Orange County, which is about 30, 40 minutes north, depending on the traffic. And we lived in Orange County, close to Villa Park. That was the nearest suburb. And Orange is quite spread out, so we were closer to Villa Park, as it were. And that's where I grew up. And it was known at the time and still is known as a hotbed for Republican views in politics, of socially conservative, economically conservative. And I did 2 years of my first 2 years of university were at University of California, Santa Barbara, which is just north of Los Angeles. And then I transferred up to Berkeley to finish my degree. And when I was at Berkeley, then I came on a year abroad here to University of Kent. And I actually studied under Leon Schlamm in the religious studies department, as well as Tony Skillen in the philosophy department. And I wrote a dissertation with Leon Schlamm on imagination and religion, and then went back to Berkeley to finish I had a semester left. And then after that, what did I do? I spent my time sort of traveling around bits of California, mostly rock climbing, since that was my main passion at the time. And then I came back to the UK for a little bit to be a part of the Temenos Academy in London, which was founded by the Prince of Wales. And they were interested in a certain aspect of ancient philosophy that I thought was interesting. And that was during that time. I don't ask me about years. My memory is very feeble. But during that time, that's when I decided to sit down and read Heidegger's Being and Time. And that was sort of the rebirth of my interest in philosophy. I went back to the States, and a good friend of mine who was a rock climber asked me if I wanted to possibly make a film with him, since we had spent so much time together. He had a video store in the college town in Santa Barbara, and I spent time working there. I actually lived in the video store with him, so we would just shut shop in at night and then carry on rock climbing and whatever it was. And so the idea of a film project came up, and the idea was we would only make the film if we can get a friend of his to edit the film. He was a professional editor, worked for Rob Reiner. He was first assistant editor for Rob Reiner, and he went on, he became editor of the, I don't think the first Hunger Games, but the sequels to it, and then he edited it. I think his first big breakthrough as independent was 300 Days of Summer or something.
Oh, yeah, like yeah, yeah.
And so his name is Alan Bell, and he agreed to do it, and so we went to shoot the film, and I don't know if...
That's wonderfully diverse, because what I think is really intriguing is the way that you have been at Kent, you went away from Kent, you came back, and you've done that more than once, but done some really different things. I mean, obviously, one thing that I'm always fascinated about, in my case, I've been in this profession for so long, but I've never really worked outside of academia. So it sounds like doing rock climbing, being involved in films. And I think there was something as well with insurance as well, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, that's right. I worked as, after we made the film, we had to pay the debt off. It was the classic thing of where, back then they didn't have digital video, so you actually had to shoot film. So we did it on 16mm black and white. And we basically, my friend Steve actually sold his video store. And so he had a lot of cash as a result of that. So he was all in. He's a great guy. He passed away a couple of years ago. But and then the rest of it we funded on credit cards, and we took out a private loan from Steve's parents. And so after the film was done being shot and in the process of being edited, I had to take a job up to start paying back the loan. And at the time, I was still in Northern California, and my parents are very generous, and I didn't ask my dad for much, and he's kind of a reserved person as well. And I think what it was is I said, "Dad, I need to find a job. Do you have any connections?" He was an attorney for in litigation. He was on defense, and he was on a few panel councils for one of a few of the big insurance companies. And he had some very good contacts at Chubb & Son, which is a very well-known insurance company. It's often called the Rolls Royce of insurance companies. They have a lot of celebrities they insure, like Bill Clinton and Clint Eastwood, Ronald Reagan, those types. And he made a call into the San Francisco office and knew the claims manager there and got me an interview. But it wasn't a shoo-in, so I had to go through 5 interviews and worked as a claims adjuster for a year. And then I moved to Wisconsin for personal reasons. And was trying to find a job in copy editing, something closer to my interests. But because I had experience at this major insurance company, it was actually very easy to get insurance jobs. So then I ended up doing more adjusting for a subsidiary of Royal & Sun Alliance, which is a British company. And then I got sick of claims, and I worked for an American insurance company called AAA, and was on the agent representative side of things, where we worked with captive agents who write the lines of insurance for the company and helping them to rate things and help improve their sales rates and so forth. And that was sort of quasi underwriting. And that was actually pretty fun because they sent me out in the field quite a bit to go visit agents, both captive and independent agents in the state. And it was very, very good company to work for. And it was at the end of that, so that was what, 2004, that an opportunity came up to do a PhD. And I wasn't planning on becoming an academic. I thought, well, I'll just do a PhD as a thing I want to do because I have this question I want to answer. And I thought, well, I knew the staff at Kent, Peter Moore in particular, and Leon Schlamm, and they would probably be somewhat sympathetic to my project. And I knew a lot of other people. I had a friend who was also a postgraduate here, and I thought, it sounds like a very productive atmosphere to be in, so then I came to Kent.
Yeah, it's interesting because sometimes when you're within the university setting, you have to work on a particular project because the nature of the job requires that you have something on the go. So you think, right, you know, this is my next book or my next article or next funding application. But in your case, you were doing such disparate things. It's almost as though, and I think Leon Schlamm was always the same because he was an accountant, wasn't he, before?
Yeah, that's right.
It's almost that sense that. So it's fascinating. So there's a clear connection there. But it's interesting that it sounds that you were doing something very different to academia, but there were these academic problems that you wanted to be sorted out, you wanted to engage with. And it's almost as though you couldn't, you know, that sense of needing to go back to a university setting and see where that was able to take you. That's very intriguing to have been doing something outside of academia, but wanting to come back into academia to do that, almost as though it was grinding away at you, and you knew that at some point you it was almost as though it was your calling, perhaps.
Yeah, in a way. So it largely came out of the idea that my experience in the workplace at the insurance company. I mean, Chubb was a very prestigious company, so it was a very high profile and sometimes constricting atmosphere to work in, but also I learned a lot, quite a few things from different generations of employees there. But there was something about the non-coincidence, to put it that way, of being in a somewhat prestigious position, or promising prestigious position, or promising position within a prestigious company, and just feeling like my soul was being leached out of me in the daily commute. I lived in the Haight-Ashbury district of San Francisco. And it took 45 minutes to take the bus from that area to the Embarcadero Center Towers, which is the main downtown area for businesses. And someone from East Bay, which is, I don't know, something like 10 times as far in terms of distance, it would take them about the same amount of time to commute and all these kinds of things. And I remember one time I was leaving at 5 o'clock right on the dot and taking the lift down to the floor to get my bus to go back home. And one of the more senior adjusters was in the lift with me. And I thought he was going home too, but actually he was going just to get coffee because he was going to carry on working. And he looked at me and he knew I was going. He just looked at me and said, "Short timer." Yeah. And he was poking fun at me, but at the same time I thought, wow, there's something toxic about this atmosphere. So I suppose in retrospect, it was essentially a philosophical question.
Yeah.
I've always had a soft spot for existentialism. I thought there must be some way of understanding the nature of human work where we can make sense of it as something that contributes to someone's flourishing. Mm-hmm. And how can one go about doing that by avoiding various philosophical pitfalls like subjectivism, or I guess subjectivism would be the main thing. So that was what drove my PhD. And it's still with me today, because now I'm back. My current research is looking at the area of meaningful work and different aspects of that.
Yeah. And do you feel then that word impact that comes up a lot in research terms, and which is also, I think, very much a grounding for the nostalgia interviews that I'm doing here, in terms of the impact on people's lives of the career and other journeys that they've taken. But do you feel that the research that you're doing has that sort of wider, almost like constituency, that because it was born out perhaps of, you know, something niggling away at you outside of an academic context, do you feel that line between the academic and the, shall we say, the world of business, or the world of insurance claims, or even rock climbing, you know, you sort of feel that there's all these sort of connections that you're able to forge because of your unique journey to where you are now?
Yeah, it's confusing and complicated, I guess, because I have a lot of friends I've met through windsurfing here that are very successful in the business sphere with in London, and they've always been interested in talking to me about various philosophical ideas. And one even has tried quite a bit to get me involved in his particular business that he was running, and that looked like I was going to be involved in restructuring, but then he sold the business. And then he tried to get the business that bought his business to be interested in my ideas. And I met with their in-house consultant, and things seemed to be going well. But then, for whatever reason, I think one of the main reasons was that they're in the midst of a private equity bid, which I don't think they ended up getting. Mm-hmm. They just didn't have follow-up. They didn't pursue any kind of follow-up with me with respect to how some of the ideas I had could improve their management structure in terms of meaningful work and virtue ethics and so forth. Mm-hmm. So that's, and one thing I do remember is when I was going for my first meeting to meet with the CEO and some senior managers, that was December 2 years ago, I got out of the tube station at Bank. And as I was walking towards the restaurant where we're having the working lunch, I had this nostalgic sort of deja vu of being back in San Francisco in a way of that kind of world, although I wasn't wearing a suit. I was kind of more dressed up than I would be for teaching here at the university. And there was a kind of thrill about that. I thought, this is, you really feel like you're a part of something creative in a different way than being at the university. And the meeting was wonderful. It was great to hear them talk about their own ideas and how ideas about, I mean, I know not all businesses fit within this, but this is the kind of business I was dealing with was a business that was very it was putting themselves out there. It wanted to improve things, not only to be profitable, but also to improve the way things are going for the employees, how they thought about, how the employees thought about their work and the kind of commitment they would have to the company. And they were the kind of company that they relied upon that kind of commitment in order to do well, because offering a high salary only gets you so far, as it were. Mm. And they had some great ideas, and to see that kind of enthusiasm about it really made me think about the question about what percentage of businesses are the kind of businesses you hear about in the media that they don't care, they except for the bottom line, and they just want certain things, and it's very pessimistic. I thought, I wonder what percentage. And I was up in February giving a talk on meaningful work at University of East Anglia, and they actually had a former consultant in the audience when I was giving my paper, and he actually said, there was another member of the audience who very sort of quasi-Marxist, very pessimistic about the and critical about the ideas I had about how to introduce these notions of meaningful work to a business, because he thought businesses just, they only care about their own profit. Mm. And he and this other consultant actually said that's, in his experience, that's not the case. If you actually get a company that cares, the CEOs and the senior officers really want to spend time thinking about ethical questions, about how to improve well-being within the organization. Mm. For whatever reason that might be. So that kind of gave me a hope. But I think it's been complicated and confusing because my own experience in the workplace, I used to run a climbing gym for 3 years, in fact, in Wisconsin. I think being on the academic side, it's all the theoretical ideas and how to apply them within a structure and a process, whereas my experience of it has always been from the ground up. I've been the one who's been in charge, or I've been involved in decision-making processes within the organization, so that, and I understand it very well, so I can see how the changes that are necessary to make. And I think particularly working for the climbing gym, which was very dependent on volunteer work from the community, as it were, to keep things going in many different ways in terms of the special events we had and so forth, you're able to find ways that are bespoke, I guess, and are able to address what you think the members of the gym are looking for, yeah, and how to encourage that, how to make things go well. And I think I did a pretty good, sorry, Surf I Sound American, where I'm patting myself on the back, but I think I did a pretty good job with that, with the other managers I worked with. And we ended up doing something that saved the life of that gym in the end, because it was about to go under, and it was sort of a crash and burn type of situation. And we decided to take the leap of faith, as it were. And to this day, the gym is doing well, and they've actually opened up a second location. So I do follow what's going on with that, and it's good to see. And I suppose that's the kind of involvement I would like to see my ideas, my philosophy, to have that kind of life, but to try and get that without forcing it, or to try and get that without playing the schmoozing game. I don't know how to do,
And well, one of the questions I'll ask you later is whether you ever imagined 20, 30 or more years ago that you'd be doing what you're doing now. But just in terms of earliest memories, because I'm fascinated that you, I mean, it sounds as though, so you grew up, you had a father who was obviously a big player, he was an attorney, and obviously you've pursued an academic career now. But what are the things that you remember doing as a child? What are the things that you particularly remember? What sort of stand out?
Yeah, so my memory is very feeble. If you ask me how long ago was, or when, what age were you, I always say I was probably 7, 8, or 9, which is probably wrong, but some people have this remarkable ability to remember age one, what they're doing. And I think all my earliest memories I only have because I've seen photographs of myself. Yeah. But I suppose one of the things that stands out the most is after my parents moved to Orange County, I had a Good Humor. Good Humor is a ice cream company. A Good Humor tricycle that had a front, a box on the front where you were supposed to put your fake ice cream. And I just remember loving that and going around the neighborhood and pushing that around on the pavement. But other than that, I don't have many memories as a child. And I think most of my vivid memories are probably in the junior high school or high school era. And
I'm interested because obviously you do a lot of sea work, and at the moment you spend a lot of time out on, is it windsurfing?
Windsurfing, that's right.
So I'm interested, obviously growing up as you did in California, was that something that you used to do back then, or was that something that you cultivated in later years?
Oh, it's interesting. So Orange, where we lived, was about 20 to 30 minutes from the coast, which doesn't seem that long, but actually in California terms, if you live that far from the coast, you're considered an inlander, and there was a bit of territorialism that went on. So my friends and I, we would get onto the beach, and my friends, some of my friends got directly into surfing. I didn't. I regret that. We all started out boogie boarding or bodyboarding or sponging, as they call it now, which is the back then it was mostly a sponge type of board that you ride on your stomach. And then what happened when I was in junior high school and high school is they innovated with a slick bottom bodyboard. And that made things a lot better. You could actually go faster and you can start doing tricks on it. So I started doing that and I enjoyed that a lot. And I thought, well, if I can do tricks on a bodyboard, why should I start surfing? Mm. And I regret that. So the first time I ever tried surfing was here in Cornwall. Yeah. And I loved it. And I'd like to go do more of it. But living here in Canterbury, Britain's got fantastic rock climbing, but Kent... Yes, with the exception of Harrison's Rocks near Tunbridge Wells, it doesn't have anything going on. There's some really nice indoor gyms around. But at the time, what was it, 5 years ago or so, or 2011, I just really didn't have anything to do. And so my wife said she always wanted to sail, and she was just going to go to Whitstable. They had a sailing school there, and said, I'm just going to try sailing. So I said, go ahead, knock yourself out. She went, and sailing's something I've never really had an interest in, sailing dinghies. And she loved it, and she said, look, I'll pay for your lesson, just go out with me. And I said, well, I don't want to do a lesson. She goes, okay, fine, you'll do a taster day. And she knows how to manipulate me. And so went out on a taster day in a large dinghy that could fit three people, and the instructor went out with us and then let me take the helm for a bit. And then we had lunch. And then I think the instructor and my wife were conspiring against me. And then the instructor said, so would you like to try a single-handed dinghy? And so I thought, okay, I went out. So I went out on a small Pico and thought it was kind of fun. It was nice being out in the sea. And what was really challenging, of course, is getting used to how the rigging works in relation to the wind, your balance and vibes. So that, I thought that was really interesting. But I knew right away it wasn't for me. I just didn't have that kind of connection with it.
It goes to show, doesn't it, is how easy it is to caricature people sometimes, because anybody might think, well, you're from California, you're doing all this windsurfing, so it's obvious that you're just carrying on a tradition of, you know, something that you learned in childhood. But obviously that's not the case, and it makes me think of a film that I saw at the cinema yesterday, which was actually filmed in Folkestone. It's got nothing to do with what we're talking about, but it was about boxing, and it was a woman who she wants to channel her frustration or anger or the bullying that she actually, it turns out, dispensed when she was a child 30 years earlier. And she goes into the boxing ring and she's told, first of all, you're not ready for this, you're not good enough. And she's told, you know, go away, and really you just haven't got what it takes. And she's like, no, I really have to do this. And she keeps going back. And then the trainer says, okay, well, we'll have a few minutes together. She said, well, okay, well, you've got something here that I can see the anger. And it's interesting, but it's that sense sometimes of almost circumstances. You look around you and you say, well, what is it that I really want to do? What are the options available here? How keen am I to do this? Together with accidents and being with somebody and being in a yeah. marriage where somebody says, well, actually, I'm interested in this. You may not be quite as interested, but if you consider this possibility, which is like a spin-off of this, then maybe we can, you know, align our interests. And it just sounds like a match made in heaven from what you're telling me.
Yeah, and it's funny because in California, I'm sure people windsurf, but where I grew up, if you windsurfed, you're a geek. And there was one guy in our high school that windsurfed, and everyone just thought he was a geek because he did it. But he kept on saying in protest, and of course, when you're that age, everything's so crazy in high school, the hormones and so forth. But he kept on windsurfing is a really difficult sport, and I'd like to see you guys go out there and do it. And I was like, yeah, whatever, you know. But having done windsurfing now, I can actually say it is the most difficult sport I've ever done. Yeah. For a lot of different reasons, and what makes the windsurfing community great is I think every windsurfer knows how difficult it is, and so there is this kind of common respect that just because you're out there, it's a good thing. And also, I mean, I could talk about the different sports cultures in California in contrast to doing sports here. And it's just night and day in a lot of ways in terms of how people interact with each other on the water. But it was really good to do it here. And that will always be one of my fondest memories is learning how to windsurf with the sailing school in Whitstable. Yeah.
And I saw someone doing that, I assume it was windsurfing, in Herne Bay a couple of summers ago. And it was a really hot summer's day. I think it was early July. and it was a Sunday, late afternoon, early evening, and the chap kept, I think he was probably a beginner, but he kept falling off, and he started again. And, you know, some people were sort of like booing or clapping or, you know, depending, but also there was a sense of respect. It was more like, well, actually, we couldn't do this, but you've picked yourself up and you're going for it again, and you have an audience. People just on the beach watching this, and you know, he chose almost to have an, well, he may not have chosen to have the audience, but certainly he got an audience because people were like, wow, you know, you're doing this amazing thing, and fair play to him. But it sounds like it's the sort of thing that, you know, once you have a taste for it, you I can imagine then that almost with the science of it as well, and making sure the right time of day, but looking at, I'm guessing that you followed the wind sort of patterns and you listen to the shipping forecast.
Sorry, wind and tides, and yeah, always looking at the forecast. Yeah. And even walking around. It's funny, if you do any kind of sport or activity that involves relationship to nature, or even to structures, because I remember I used to skateboard, and you'd always be looking at certain man-made structures in terms of, ooh, that's a good transition, or whatever it might be. But I think you just start to see things through that mode of being, as it were. So always when there's leaves rustling, you think, oh, wind, where is it, what direction is that coming from? And then what speed is that? Mm-hmm. And I've spent so much time now, I mean, the amount of hours since 2011 I've spent out on the sea in Whitstable. Yeah. I think I've probably clocked in the most hours of any local sailor there. Yeah. But you do get a kind of intimacy with that aspect of nature, and also a great deal of respect for it at the same time.
And it's a very good counterpoint to the academic work, because I find that when I've got other things on the go, often involving film or even indeed doing radio-based, you know, podcasts, etc., that actually it's often a good driver for some of the academic writing, or the teaching, which sometimes involves, you know, wearing a different hat, that sometimes that it being pushed in one direction rather than exhausts you and takes away the opportunity to do something else. You can do the things concurrently, which is why I often feel that people might sometimes think, but Chris always seems to be on Facebook. But of course, often I'm writing something, and you know, it's almost as though you've got that one thing going on in your head sometimes can push you in another area. And I find that I'm at my most productive when I've got more than one thing on the go at the same time.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And then certainly I couldn't be an academic without having some kind of sport to do, like windsurfing. I think I'd just go nuts. I'm not the kind of academic that can just fully commit him or herself to reading as much as possible and having a view on it. And I would probably shrivel up if that were the case. Yeah. But yeah, I do agree with you that having a lot of things that you're genuinely interested in make you more productive and more engaged.
Yeah. And one thing that always intrigued me when I was growing up, but the thing that really excited me was the charts, the music, what was going on around me. You know, that was the thing that we'd always talk about in the playground at school. You know, what number is your favorite song in the charts? And there was a bit of competition there as well. If my favorite song was doing better in the charts than someone else's, it almost sort of endorsed my often quite quirky tastes. I mean, the stuff I used to listen to were not necessarily representative, shall we say, of what everybody in my school would be interested in. But was that something that intersected at all with your own background? Were you aware of what was going on musically as a child?
Yeah, I never was, and never have been, never will be someone that keeps up on things that are going. So with music in particular, I've always been a follower. So whatever my friends were listening to, I would more or less listen to. And the funny thing is, and I do remember this in elementary school, the British rock scene was huge. Yeah. So, and Quadrophenia was something that my friends thought was absolutely cool. And that was stood in stark contrast to another group of mostly boys that were into American heavy metal. So it sort of mimicked the Quadrophenia scene and the rockers and the mods. And a lot of my friends, I didn't dress up as a mod or a ska, but a lot of my friends quickly adapted that kind of the clothing style. At the same time, I got into breakdancing because of my brother. And so if I wore any kind of distinguished clothing, it would be the parachute pants and so forth. And it was just sort of very faddish. So mod ska to breakdance, hip-hop, rap, early hip-hop rap. And then as I got more into skateboarding, as I got out of breakdancing and skateboarding, it became skate punk, so Minor Threat and News Now Fugazi. And then I don't even know what I used to listen to in high school, because I got heavily into wrestling and not quite sure. Maybe it was just whatever was I remember the big radio station of Southern California was K-Rock 106.7. And they had a lot of British music, but other things like that.
And the song that I always associate there, and I played the video actually not too long ago was Starship. We built the city on rock and roll because that's got all the different. That is that San Francisco, I think, and it's got the frequency of the radio station. I don't know if it's a fictitious station in the song itself.
Oh, right.
And that's very sort of. I don't know if that is California, but I certainly associate that with, you know, a point in the mid 1980s and the sense of this other. You know, because I was obsessed with Radio One or, you know, BBC stations over here, but this sense of there being almost something so cool about American radio. I mean, admittedly, when I went to America some years ago and I sampled this, there just seemed to be adverts everywhere, and I thought, no, this isn't what I'm used to.
Yeah,
but a real sort of conjuring up a particular time and place.
Yeah, it is, and I guess the other memories I'm thinking about being in the back of a car because I'm not able to drive, and just the radio being on, and remembering certain songs. As they relate to specific locations or specific things that I was doing. So those are always fond. And but every time I go back to Southern California, every time I go back, it's sort of a different perception. But the odd thing is, I associate a lot of memories of Southern California, and I don't actually, having lived close to Los Angeles, I didn't spend much time there. I didn't like it as a kid. I didn't like it when I was at university. We used to have to pass through Los Angeles to go to the desert to go climbing. And my friend and I, Steve, we were sure that we'd always be ill after having to pass through the smog in some crazy way. And it would affect our moods and so forth, but that was probably just us. But having been back to Los Angeles really recently for a conference that I helped organize there, I had to stay in Los Angeles in the city center, and I had a different appreciation for it. And I was taking the train system between the hotel and the conference venue, and realizing that I was passing through the area of the riots that were spurred on by Rodney King, the beating of Rodney King. And I realized very shamefully I didn't know very much about the riots. And so after the conference was over, I was looking around and found on Netflix there was a documentary called, I think it's called Let It Burn, if I recall correctly. I thought, well, I'll watch this. And it follows, the documentary basically makes a case for all the events leading up to the Rodney King riots. And it starts several decades before, and the certain kinds of ideas and practices that the police force had with respect to African Americans. And I learned so much and got to see the locations I was passing through the historical documentary. And of course, the racial tension is not solved within that city. And I had a really just different view of Los Angeles. I knew all that was there. I knew all the gangs were there and that kind of thing. But this gave me a very different relationship to a different appreciation for Los Angeles that I never had before. I couldn't have had that, perhaps. Well, I like to think, unless I'd lived here in Britain, because now I'm so far removed from American culture that when I go back, I don't see myself as American. I don't see myself as British. I'm sort of a sea in that way. But to go back to Southern California and see it as foreign in many different ways was very eye-opening for me.
Yeah. And does that happen when you're here? Because I'm guessing that when you hear those particular music or, you know, the Rodney, that was, what, summer 92, wasn't it? Because I remember that was a big thing in the run-up to, well, before Clinton was elected, and it was the way that, you know, it almost sort of like characterised the end of the George H.W. Bush era, that the Rodney King shooting, it sort of sounded that, you know, who was that filmmaker? John Singleton, I think he made Boys in the Hood around that time. So, because this is all me coming at it from a completely detached point of view of reading about it in the newspapers, as it would have been in those days, or hearing about it on the radio, but living through that era, how do you feel now that you're in a different country? And do you sort of feel a real sense of distance? Like you identify with that period, you remember it, but also it's at a substantial remove, not just in terms of time, but in terms of where you are in your life now, in terms of location. How does that affect, you know, same with music, isn't it? That when you listen back to that, what sort of associations does it conjure up?
Yeah, it's sort of a sense of, maybe guilt's too strong of a word, because at the time, listening to that, to the new wave of at that time, hip hop, so N.W.A., in particular, Eazy-E was an offshoot of N.W.A. It was basically suburban kids in Southern California in their cars that their parents had bought them, listening to this rap, thinking they're tough, going to parties, keggers, as it were, and just thinking that you're a part of this cutting-edge, rough lifestyle, and really you're just living in suburban California. I mean, that's not to say there were actually gangs in Southern California and that in the affluent neighborhoods. My brother was a member of a Mexican gang. It got pretty serious. But there's that sense I have as a result of being outside of California for so long. And I'm just trying to think along racial lines, because I grew up in Southern California as an Asian American in a time where there were quite a few Asian Americans at my high school and quite a few in that part of Orange County. And the stigma, of course, was that it's large. I mean, people associate with 16 Candles, but the character Long Duk Dong. And so to be an Asian American, you were a nerd. And even though I don't see myself as being Chinese or Japanese in a very strong ethnic sense, because I grew up in Southern California, there's nonetheless, I do recognize that I was different within that particular culture. My brother, who's 3 years older than me, I think particularly had a hard time with that. And I think because he had a hard time with it, it sheltered me a bit from that experience. I did experience, it's not racism, it's not bigotry at that age. I think it's just people passively inherit certain views, and because you're different, they treat you as, because they're told you're different, that I'm different, for example, then they treat you as different. So there was always that kind of tension. I always felt growing up that I had to do more to demonstrate, to validate myself. And this is going to be a classic psychological, binary relationship, but I always felt like I had to do more to validate myself in their eyes. Mm-hmm. And that was mostly had to do with physical prowess, as it were, because if you were just smart, that only reinforced the stereotype that you were a nerd. So the idea was you should be both secretly, silently, covertly smart and doing well academically, but then excelling at the level of athletics, whether it's school athletics or it's like surfing or skateboarding outside of that. So I'm not sure how I got onto this, but it's sort of around this murky area and this confusion I have about growing up in a racially charged time and area, and recognizing that, but not quite fully understanding what's going on and getting a different perspective. I don't know if it's a better perspective, but getting a different perspective after having lived here since 2004, very different. So it is strange and something that, I'm not quite sure what kind of role it has in my life, but as I've just said, it has been very foundational to the way I've approached certain things.
No, and often I think it's the case for many people. Often incidental things or things at the time that passed you by or couldn't process, maybe to do with age or taboos in society. But you know, decades later, anything unresolved needs to have an outlet somehow. And I think that whether it's fighting or windsailing or doing interviews or academic writing, there is a sense sometimes in which, you know, those things that niggle away at you will always niggle away at you, and unless you actually try and say, well, this is obviously something that is part of my unique identity. You know, you're talking to people and you think, I've got a very different background to these people, or why does this really impact on me in the way that it does? And I think that often it's other people's differentness or the way that other people have a different sort of narrative that sometimes makes you say, well, actually I have my own, and it's a very different one to yours, and I feel that I need to, in my own way, disseminate that.
Yeah, that's right.
And because we covered obviously how you got into academia, which is quite a circuitous route, really, but both as an undergraduate in America and here, and then later as a postgraduate. What about the teachers, for example, who inspired you? What were the sort of motivations, whether indeed, I guess, as I sometimes feel must be the case with myself, that the people who taught you in some way made you sort of think, well, actually, that's the way I want to do it or not do it myself, that, you know, you're sort of channeling somebody else's teaching technique or enthusiasm for pedagogy?
Yeah, it's a difficult question. I mean, I remember one teacher in high school being very, I don't know if inspirational is the right word, but there was something about his whole approach to the study of literature that I liked quite a bit, Norman Johnson. And he was there was another English teacher who was very involved in trying to shape how I thought, which at the time I thought was great, but in retrospect, I thought it was a bit invasive. I think it was invasive. Whereas Norman Johnson had he's in the background. He had a very dry sense of humor. And if he didn't like what you were doing, whether because you were messing around in class, he always had this nice way of making fun of you without making you feel bad about yourself. And one day I remember sort of vaguely, He said, "So Todd, it seems like you have a real interest in the absurd." I said, "Yeah, I think the idea was the absurd provided such a great contrast to Southern California living, where everything's so clean and supposed to make sense." And he said, "Here, you should read this play by Ionesco about rhinoceroses." And it's a very short play, and it's just about these two characters discussing whether or not a rhinoceros is African or Asian. So very similar to a Monty Python sketch in a way. And I was thinking, you know, Norman's view was that there is no meaning to this play, and it just shows the absurdity of some of the discussions we have. And of course, as a student, I was looking for the meaning. Yeah. What is the meaning of this play? And it wasn't until weeks later that Norman asked me, "How did you get on with the play?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm just still trying to understand what the symbolism." And he said, "There is no symbolism. It's just two people. You know, there's no answer to the question." And so that was a great shock to me in a good way. And not so much as teaching style, but just as approach to things, I suppose. And I guess with teaching style, I've never really had anyone in particular. Well, I think of memorable teachers. I think of people who have changed my perception on things. And at high school, I was supposed to be one of the top students, especially in English literature. But I think I suffered from this idea that in order to appear smart, you had to write in complex ways and complex sentences and so forth. I think I had a real hang-up about that. And it wasn't until my first year at UCSB, I basically decided on my own, I'm going to take an English 101 module. Mm-hmm. But it was not taught by the English department. This one was, I think it was within some kind of linguistics department. And the teacher there, I've forgotten her name, unfortunately, but she had a very experimental approach to getting students to understand how language works. And her, the way she approached it, cleared the slate for me and allowed me to see English in a different way. I think it took a while for my writing to improve, but still I saw it in a different way. And it helped me rethink the way in which I tried to articulate myself in an academic setting. And then I'm just another teacher in political science. I hated Plato. I remember throwing The Republic against the wall as an undergraduate. This is ridiculous. I was really irritated with Glaucon because he disagrees with Socrates. I think most students are. And this professor, Escandari, said to me, "What if Plato is doing that intentionally, not because he needs someone to agree with his character Socrates, but because he's trying to indicate something?" So that got me to read the Republic in a different way, and that was very opening. And then I wanted to be a poet very dearly when I was an undergraduate. So when I was at Berkeley, it was, of course, if you wanted to be a filmmaker, you go to Los Angeles. So you either go to USC or you go to UCLA. If you want to be a poet, you go to UC Berkeley because the beat scene and all the poets that are still living around there. And I had an American poetry class with Bob Haas, who at the time, I think in about 3 or 4 years, was going to be the American Poet Laureate. And he was fantastic. And his lectures were more or less, he would talk about poetry or the specific poetry, but he had all these stories to tell about poets that everyone, I think, was just captivated by that. And then, of course, everyone was waiting for him to read poetry. And so he would read the poetry of others. And it was just absolutely, that was one of my favorite classes. It was learning about something without actually learning in the typical way in which we go about it. And he was always involved. I'd run into him every now and then at a bar or something. And I didn't think he'd remember me, but he would come up and say something to me. And I kept in correspondence with him. And then another poet I met was Fanny Howe, who was at University of San Diego, who was a part of the exchange program. I met her through coming here to Kent as an undergraduate. And 2 years ago, I was at Boston College for a conference that I was organizing with the Society for Recurse Studies and with Boston College and Boston University. And Richard Carney, a famous philosopher, was one of the keynotes. And Richard Carney, I didn't know, is very close friends with Fanny Howe. So on the night that Richard gave his keynote and we had the reception afterwards, Fanny Howe walks up to me after I had not seen her since, 1995? Walks up to me and said, "I've been waiting to talk to you for the longest time." Yeah. And we had this talk for about an hour at the reception, just going over things about about memories, but also she wanted to talk a certain kind of philosophy with me. And that was absolutely wonderful. But it was also after that, it was that, you know, that encounter is done. It's over. It's not like we're going to keep it. And we both sort of, it was an odd moment. You just recognize that. And it was sort of saying goodbye was, I hope your life goes well. And that was it. So it was.
Yeah, and often there's that sense of needing to prove yourself to people that maybe taught you many years earlier and who may or may not have seen your potential, but you almost want to say to them, you know, it's okay, it worked out well. Or almost a way of saying, you may have had a particular perception of me, which I want to counter by almost sort of saying, yeah, I was that shy person, or I was that person who seemed a bit geeky, or I was a bit awkward in class, but now look what I'm doing. And it's almost, and it's quite a nice, and I guess it works both ways, because I always like it when my students keep in touch and they tell me what they're up to. And in one case, I had a student who said, and I wasn't quite sure how to take this, he said he was so inspired by some of the biblical studies and film stuff that I was doing, looking at Jesus epics, etc. And he said he went off and made his own film somewhere, I think in Africa. And so, you know, sort of strange threads. It's like, well, I didn't directly bring that about, but in some way there was obviously sitting in a lecture and thinking, I'm intrigued by this. I want to see where this journey takes me. Yeah. And it sounds as though you've had that, but also how wonderful then to have that moment when you can speak to somebody almost like adult to adult and sort of say, you know, this is where I am, and you've changed each other, perhaps.
Yeah. You know, just as you're saying that, I realize how much I've been shaped by opposition.
Yeah.
Because I've had some very, there's been a lot of, always a lot of agonism in my life, and maybe it comes down to astrology because I'm an Aries. But two things. I mean, when I was on exchange here at Kent, I was basically told I was going to fail my Shakespeare seminar because basically I was being difficult in seminar. I didn't like the way it was being taught. And it was halfway through the year that this particular member of staff within the School of English said, I just want to tell you you're failing the module and there's nothing you can do about it. You've been coming to seminar every week, but I've not counted you present for participation. And it started because during the first 2 weeks I was trying to contribute and he just shut me down and embarrassed me in front of all the other students. And luckily at the time I was taking a South African literature class with Carolyn Rooney, who's still here. And I was doing quite well in her class. And she was also a seminar leader for the Shakespeare course. And so I went up to her and I said, I'm having a really difficult time with my seminar. Is there any possibility I can transfer into your seminar? And she said, yes. And I said, also, I've been told I'm failing the module because of the participation. And she said, we'll begin again. And just gave me the benefit of the doubt. And that was great. But I just, from that negative encounter, I thought, if I'm ever in a teaching position, I'm never going to be that kind of teacher. Yeah. Or I had a very bad encounter with a very famous classical philosopher who I think is still alive. He was at Berkeley. And I remember I wanted to do an independent study with him on Plotinus, looking at the Enneads. And so he was quizzing me on some things and basically said I was stupid and that you shouldn't even consider doing philosophy. And I just thought, if that were me, I would have said, I don't have that same interest as you in this approach to Plotinus. If you'd like, I can't supervise you, but if you'd like to do this, here's someone within the philosophy department, the classics department, who might be more amenable to what you want to do, as opposed to just saying, you know, you're stupid, you should. I mean, wielding that kind of authority people just don't see how damaging it can be.
Well, and it's the analogy is what we do in what is religion with the concept of tactical definitions. You know, often that what you encounter says as much, or rather says more about the person saying it than about you.
Yeah.
In other words, in the same way that we say, well, when somebody says how terrible religion is, it's like, well, really that says about you and your particular hang-ups than about the subject you're studying. And I think in the same way here, it sounds as though somebody, whether it was jealousy or just a sense that people couldn't think outside their own box. But then rather than say, as I do with my students, that's a fascinating angle, let me explore that further, you've made me think about my research differently, so this is mutually beneficial. The idea that you then say to somebody, you're not allowed to have that view. Unfortunately, that was something that happened, thankfully not to me, but to some of my friends at school, who would have English teachers who would take the line that, you know, if you wrote an essay, if you didn't include on Shakespeare or whatever, unless you included reference to particular dimensions of the play, the tragedy that's being read, then you wouldn't get the marks. So the teacher would go through and say, you know, maybe they'd look out for the grammar, but they'd also look out to see the content and would actually say, well, I'm looking for a check on, there's a checklist of 10 things you should mention. You only mentioned 3 of them, therefore you get 3 out of 10. And how that destroyed some people's self-esteem. And for them, it was always like, oh, I hate English because it's either right or it isn't. And I'm like, well, no, that's not my apprehension of the subject. Right. So, and, you know, and all because the teacher clearly was teaching in a style that was contrary to what education should be about, which is about human flourishing.
Yeah, I think back then, maybe still today, it's about being a certain kind of intellectual figure within and having, expecting how things should be as a result of that. I'm also thinking of coaches as well within what about experience. And I've been very fortunate here in Whitstable. There have been, I've received tuition from excellent teachers. The guy who used to run the sailing school, Jason Wild, was absolutely a fantastic teacher with respect to sailing and windsurfing. And then the Pardo brothers, Nick and Pip Pardo, just fantastic. Just the way they teach and how there was something very remarkable about the way those three were able to teach their sport, and very different approaches. But I was just very impressed by the kind of patience and the way they can intervene and how they can get someone enthusiastic about it. And Saturday was it? I was out in the water with Pip Pardo, who's usually in Greece because that's where he instructs, and he's a really good windsurfer. And I've been trying to do certain things that he can obviously do. So trying to get him to help me out. So he just went out in the water with me and said, right, so we're going to film you. And it's winds going 40 to 50 miles an hour. So it's absolutely crazy out there. And I wouldn't be trying these kinds of things in those winds because there's a chance you're going to get hurt. But with Pip there, Pip's the kind of guy that's always going to encourage you to believe in yourself.
Yeah.
And there's so many times where Pip's been involved in trying to coach someone where he gets them to believe in himself, they do it. And so Pip was out there and I was trying these things. And it's just great to see that kind of effect, because as an academic, you're always used to be on the other side of being the teacher. And then to be put in the other situation is a bit uncomfortable. But it's also good to sort of refresh yourself.
But it also comes down to that sense of authenticity. In the same way, when I'm teaching, you know, you need to be authoritative, but you don't need to be hierarchical. Or the students need to be aware of the hierarchy, that you're the teacher and they're the students. And the seminars or the lectures wouldn't necessarily function without that coordination. But it's the mutual respect. Once you've got the respect, then actually it works. It's not a case of thinking, oh, I'm on the other side of that artificial or otherwise dividing line that separates the teacher from the student.
Yeah. I think with as I've observed in your teaching, I think we share a similar interest or aim. It's that to get the students excited about what they're studying and then let them make of it as they will. I think maybe most lecturers try to approach it that way. But it's sort of to see some kind of connection to the student where they take something from something they've encountered in your module and they see it as applying to something in their life. I think once they have that connection, then they'll never forget it. And who knows what direction it will go in. I suppose that's what makes teaching at this level rewarding.
And I was intrigued by something you said earlier on about growing up in a very Republican area of California. Now you've obviously moved over to Whitstable. But in terms of politics, do you feel that there are any sort of similarities in terms of being in a particular part of the world where, not least with obviously Brexit, which may or may not be happening, do you sort of feel that there are all these sort of dynamics going on here that seem very similar to what you grew up with? In terms of witnessing Republican politics in America, or you know, dealing with conservative politics in East Kent, how do you kind of feel about that sort of connection between a particular political sensibility and how you fit in relation to that?
I think in terms of the national cultures, I always feel more comfortable within Britain, because at the level at which politicians and newscasters speak, it's always more articulate. And in particular with the newscasters, well, I listen mostly to the BBC, they don't shout at you. Whereas if you go to the States, no matter what you're listening to, but particularly Fox News or if it can be CNN, whatever it is, they're always shouting at you through the television or the radio, whatever it might be. And I find that very destructive, very harmful for a person's psyche and how they can relate to other people. So I appreciate that very much here within Britain. And I always think that whenever I'm listening to interviews of politicians, there at least is amongst all the rhetoric, there at least is an attempt usually to give some kind of reason or rationality, whereas you don't really get that in the States, at least not my experience of it, which I also find find irritating. Mm-hmm. As far as being in Whitsville, which is, I mean, Kent is obviously very, very conservative in many ways. Yeah, I don't know. I don't have much to say about that, except I have anecdotes. I have classic anecdotes, such as having a conversation with someone from Whitsville saying how much they don't like immigrants. To me, not realize, or for some reason not seeing me as an immigrant. Yeah. And to another person who is also an immigrant, not seeing them as an immigrant, because they weren't shouting at us. They were just complaining about how I just thought, this is, I, so this does happen.
But there is that assumption sometimes, isn't there, that they think that you're going to share their particular sensibility. I had it in Ramsgate about 13, 14 years ago at a bus stop, and it wasn't clear where the end of the line was or the beginning of the line. It was a bit sort of misshapen, and it wasn't sure clear which bus people were getting on at. And I happened to go to the wrong end of the line. I went to the beginning, not the end, and somebody said, "Oi, you know, you've got to go back. Don't jump in the queue." And then he said, "But you're all right." And it was like, "Well, we don't mind you because you're one of us." And there was some reference, and I forget the actual word. I'm sure I've blanked it from my head. But it was almost a sort of reference to, but if you're one of those, you know, foreigners, it's almost as though, well, of course they're going to push in because they're not like us, are they?
Yeah.
And it was this assumption that I was thinking, do you know what? I'm not sure I've got anything in common with you. But it was just this assumption because I, in some way, look like him, that therefore I'm going to agree. And I just thought, my God, I can't wait to get to the back of that queue. In fact, actually, I may get on a different bus because I do not want this conversation to continue all the way to Dover or wherever it was that I was travelling. But very peculiar, whereby people feel almost like comfortable thinking that they found a kindred spirit, and you think, you don't know me at all.
Yeah, so assumptions made in both ways. I was having a discussion with my parents about, because talking politics now is so contentious in the States, and I suppose here, although I've not experienced it here, although I've had conversations with people who have completely different views, it's always been very civil. And I just, I guess maybe naively, I think that's just sort of the British approach to discussion. It tends to be very, very patient and respectful. Although I've seen instances where it's not been, but on the whole, that's been my experience. Whereas in the States, it seems very problematic right now. And I was talking to my parents. I said, "Well, maybe there's a new way we have to approach discussion. It's actually not in jumping straight to the idea that I'm right and you're wrong, or we're trying to prove we're both in the game of trying to see who's right or wrong." Maybe it's really on the focus of, do I actually understand what you're saying? Mm. And asking the right questions to get there. I know that sounds pretty obvious in many ways, but I don't think that happens even in academic settings where you're actually asking the right questions to fully understand what's being said. And philosophy is supposed to be about that. And I think you do get philosophers who are very good about that. I think Michael Sandel in particular is very, very good at that. But I'm always reminded of the, at least as I've been told, I don't know how true this is, it might be fake news, but I was told by a reputable source that in the Middle Ages, there was this convention of engaging in scholarly debate where in order to argue with somebody, you had to present that person's position to their satisfaction before you could start asking critical questions. And I thought, what a wonderful rule. If we had that today in politics and in academia, may take a lot of time, but it would probably prevent a lot of misunderstandings.
And because that's the way that politicians, whether in Britain and at the House of Commons, say for Prime Minister's Question Time, or in America with the big debates with Hillary Clinton when she was about to face Trump, she'd have one of her team playing the role of the opposite number in order to get her to, you know, ensure that when she was on stage, she was ready for whatever onslaught might come. And I think that's interesting, that sort of seeing the world through somebody else's eyes and knowing their technique in order to understand them rather than just being oppositional to them. It's a way of, once you understand them, then you can perhaps meet them on their territory and potentially actually wrong foot them.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. I guess knowing the enemy, keeping your enemies closer in a certain way.
Yeah. And does this all apply to religion as well? Because obviously you've worked in religious studies department, but also in terms of growing up in America. Do you find that religion, like politics, is something that can be very sort of divisive?
Yeah, I actually find that I pretty much refuse to speak about religion unless someone is actually earnestly pursuing it, not with respect to having an argument they want to make. Because I find that to actually understand what's going on in religion is difficult, or to actually understand religion in any sense which is not reactive to some position. So I do believe that atheism is a reaction to a certain kind of theism. So whatever atheism you occupy is going to be a reaction. And so you can't just say, I'm an atheist. You have to say, I'm an atheist because I disagree with this conception of religion, or I disagree with this conception of God. And to actually begin to start to see that is very difficult, because everybody has a certain kind of view or platform they want to raise. And I don't know where I fall on the spectrum between theism and atheism. I know what I know the kinds of positions I am not comfortable with, but I think within the discipline of philosophy, I think the majority of philosophers tend towards the agnostic or atheistic side, and sometimes very strongly so. And even with philosophers, sometimes it's very difficult to say, can we approach religion, for example, with the understanding that religious language is non-propositional? And of course, they might say, yes, but if that's the case, then it's nonsense anyway. So it becomes very difficult to sort of build bridges. And at the end of the day, I sort of think, well, unless we're in a forum on understanding religion, then I probably don't want to talk about it.
No,
too much.
And I always find it very uncomfortable sometimes, because I realize that we're on completely different wavelengths. That I've been to talks with philosophers, and I think you've probably been to them as well, where often we have a religious studies professor and a philosophy professor debating the existence of God. But it often gets into wider topics that, if you can in some way, inverted commas, disprove God or see the logical fallacy of the ontological argument, etc., that somehow you do away with religion. We were talking about the what is religion module earlier, and I would sometimes think, well, hang on a minute, we've been looking at functionalist approaches to religion, and shopping might be a religion, or film might be a religion. So somehow looking at what Aquinas may have thought, or, you know, looking at particular arguments, you know, the watchmaker argument, somehow doesn't really do justice.
Yeah.
And I think that's the problem. The assumption is religion equals God. And then I've had some very awkward conversations in McDonald's, in supermarkets, where people know that I teach religious studies, and you realize that we're talking on completely different wavelengths. And I actually find that very uncomfortable, because I realize that anything I say or don't say is going to affect that person's apprehension of me. And potentially we're going to have a standoff, or, you know, they're going to actually find something antagonistic because I haven't said something that conforms to a particular paradigm that they're somehow expecting or hoping that I will
confirm in some way.
Yeah.
You're the expert. Confirm my view.
And I think, yeah, join my module, and then it's okay. Then actually I'm okay then, because it's on different sort of terms, whereby I'm not being wrong-footed by somebody, who happened to me actually not long ago when I was in McDonald's, where a chap was trying to get me to talk about whether I was a believer or not. And it turned out he was a pastor, and because I gave away what I did, but it was only at the end that he said what he did. And I thought I learned a valuable lesson there, because I was on the defensive, and he didn't like I've never played poker, and you can see why. I should have known that, you know, the cards that I was playing before I started to try and almost reveal them.
This is where some deconstruction might be helpful. When I used to teach philosophy of religion, inevitably students would ask me whether or not I was an atheist or a theist, and I would just say, of course, you know what Jacques Derrida would say, impossible, that question is impossible. And I'd leave it at that. Like, what does that mean? What is? I don't know. But I had to teach religion the other day for the MA, because we were looking at Paul Ricoeur on the religious significance of atheism, the Nietzschean and Freudian kind. And I began speaking, and I stopped myself, and I said to my students, look, whenever we discuss religion philosophically, it doesn't matter, because what's going to happen, either it's going to be entirely blandly dry and desiccated of any kind of substance that might be religious, because we're trying to secularize it in some way, or it's going to get really spooky fast. And with Ricoeur, of course, Ricoeur tries to maintain a certain kind of discourse about it, but inevitably it gets a little bit spooky on it, just because he talks about this kind of fidelity you have to existence or to language. And kind of
but it's funny, isn't it, that it's always, I find, in religious studies, I very rarely get asked that question. I mean, certainly with my students, they never ask me, I never ask them about their particular faith paradigms. Often it comes out, of course, naturally and organically through classes. Sometimes somebody might reveal their faith position. But it's only often with people outside of my, as it were, community of scholars, that the question of religion and faith identity does tend to come up. And that's very peculiar. It's almost as though when I'm teaching religious studies, it's the elephant in the room, but nobody's asking it. But I'm more defensive then when I'm with people who are not studying religion. And of course, their questions then wrong foot you, because they're almost like they're going to ask what their thinking was with in religious studies often were aware of those different, and you know, the need to be sensitive to different people's points of view, and so therefore asking the outright question, do you believe in God, etc., is something that just wouldn't happen because it's crossing lots of lines that you'd be skilled enough to know that you shouldn't cross.
Right, so certain conventions of discussion, that's interesting.
So that's the best way. If you don't want to talk about religion, become a religious studies professor and you can get through your whole career and actually, you know, initiate the conversations that you want to.
Yeah,
never be defensive.
With philosophy it is. So what's the meaning of life?
Yeah, yeah, I get asked that too sometimes. Mm. A few more, philosophically based questions, I guess, just to wrap up. I mean, would you say that your memories are predominantly positive ones across your whole span of life?
Yeah, I suppose they are, even the negative ones, because I'm, I guess what I've described is my oppositional nature. I tend, in retrospect or through revision, I see those negative encounters, which are perhaps traumatic at the time, as contributing positively, of course, with a cost. And whether or not they've actually had a positive outcome, who's to say? But there's a part of me that's very optimistic and a part of me that's very pessimistic. My friends used to call me the gloom because they think I was so down all the time about certain things. But I think that's my way of being down about things is a way for me to react to things and to do things in a certain way. So it's a kind of provisional pessimism or cynicism, I guess you could say. So I think I guess what I'm trying to say is a larger momentum of my way of thinking is positive, but it requires a lot of work and detours for me to get there. So the memories that I have, it's sort of a, I don't know, kind of work of mourning in some way.
I suppose there's a related question to that, which is as to whether it's possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences, or indeed, as I was saying actually with another philosopher, Simon, when I interviewed him a while ago, that question of whether you can be nostalgic for something that didn't happen but you wished had have happened.
Yeah. Well, I never thought I would do this, but I'm going to refer to Sartre. I'm not a big fan of Sartre's philosophy, but perhaps he has something to contribute here, whereas if nostalgia is something that we're drawing on in order to do something that we think is constructive or positive, he wouldn't put it that way. He'd be a bit more decisive in relation to authenticity. Then it's a good thing, but whereas when nostalgia ever forces you into this position of wishing, then he would see that as destructive and counterproductive. And I guess the most nostalgic memories I have, for example, of rock climbing with friends in California, Wisconsin, of learning how to windsurf here, there's a fine line in which they can drive you to do things in terms of projects, as the existentialists would say, with goals and aims, or it can regress into a mode of, well, it's not like that now. I wish it was. Why can't I go back? I think then that becomes problematic because it may not necessarily be the case. You can recreate those conditions or you can change the conditions you're in, but maybe it means you need a break or maybe need to move on to something else. Yeah. And I think if we were a bit more mobile like that, existentially mobile, perhaps that may be a new topic of research, then... I think that would be positive, but it also might change what we expect of life in general institutions we have.
And the question that I think earlier said I would ask is whether you feel that you have fulfilled the dreams that you had when you were young, or indeed whether, I'm guessing that, 30, 40 years ago, you wouldn't have imagined that you are where you are now. And how do you feel about that?
Yeah, so when I was young, I wanted to be an FBI agent. This is before X-Files, too. I just had this idea of working for the government was synonymous with doing right, and then you're also being an investigator detective, and being American, you get to hold a gun, so it somehow validates your existence in some way. I would never guess where I'd be where I am today, especially with my experience as an undergraduate in many different ways. I'm very thankful for where I am, and I suppose... on the theme of nostalgia, I am always, whether it's good or bad, I'm always looking for that sense of adventure and fulfillment that I've had through rock climbing and through windsurf. I have to say that if it were either or of you get windsurfing or rock climbing on the one hand or academia on the other, I would just choose the sport.
Yeah.
And I remember being at a conference and asking two philosophical colleagues who were rock climbers about the questions. So is it more rewarding to get that journal article published in a peer-reviewed journal that has like a 3% or less acceptance rate, or completing that project? And without question, it was completing the project. And yeah. there is some sense of fulfillment with prestigious publication, but there is something about being, I guess for me, there's a way of being engaged and invested in something of a physical nature that allows you to feel that you're experiencing something meaningful.
It is funny, isn't it, that sort of that sense of alterity that almost, I think in my case, yes, I teach, I write books, I meet students as senior tutor, that I sort of tick all those boxes. But and I have this thirst for knowledge and this inquiring mind. I'm doing these nostalgia interviews, etc. But there's a part of me that knows that what would make it for me would be sitting in a radio studio, counting down the charts and actually engaging with an audience, doing quizzes, the sort of things that I do on Facebook with film or music. But it's interesting that for me, it's almost as though, but rather than sort of like Chris wants to do something very trivial, it's the opposite. It's almost as though it's the balance between all of those things. It's not like all I would do is read charts out every week. It's, it's having that, the same thirst for knowledge, but having a different way of disseminating it and having a different sort of outlet, which is on your terms rather than just sort of saying, gosh, I must please that particular ref coordinator or that colleague to ensure that I've got a good, well-liked or well-reviewed article for the next ref. It's very interesting that it's almost there's something outside of that whole process completely that always is my compass. It's outside of rather than within my day-to-day sphere of operation.
Yeah, that's funny. I can see you as a radio DJ. I can see that. I can see you very well situated. Of course, you'd have different standards. What's your audience target? And here's it. Your demographic's dropping, Chris. We need you to talk about more controversial things like Brexit. No, that's not my thing.
I just want to play Helen Shapiro. But the two can go together, though. And I think some of the best presenters have demonstrated that. I mean, I suppose you saw it with Jimmy Young, you see it with Jeremy Vine to a point. But the way in which you can flip between very disparate subjects, but to do it seamlessly, because you're in control of that. And that's why I'm really looking forward to going back over these interviews and adding the jingles, because then it's almost as though you've got all the sort of ingredients of what a good radio program would have. Yeah. But in a way that doesn't sound completely silly, because it's being coordinated in a way that there's some, that's the key thing, there's substance or depth underlying all of that.
Yeah.
And it's that background context and I guess enthusiasm that sort of makes it credible, but in a way that perhaps nobody else would do in quite the same way.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. And just a couple more questions. Are you in touch with your friends from your past? I mean, your rock climbing days, for example, are you still in touch with them?
Yes, I am. I was particularly sad to lose my good friend Steve that I made the film with, Steve Edwards. He's the kind of guy that when you meet him, you think he's always bringing in a sense of adventure, a very generous, he's a fantastic all-around person, but you always feel, everyone thinks that he's your best friend. That's the kind of person he is. Because you always want to be with him. He's very generous with his time. But that group of friends from California, Wisconsin, and whenever I see them, it's always as if, a lot of time has passed. But then when you're together, it just feels like not much time has passed, that kind of thing. And and I still maintain contact with them. I think one of the things that keeps us together so much is Steve had a. We have all these friends that sort of are satellites around Steve. Or we're satellites around Steve in a certain way. Steve had a very distinct sense of humor. And the more time you spent with him, the more you got the sense of humor in terms of understood it, and more it became part of how you lived. And so I think one of these things with this group of friends is we all have these stories, but also the same sense of humor and outlook on life, generally speaking, that keeps us together. And that's something that's remarkable. Now, here, cultural differences and this is just my experience. I think the cliche is it's very easy to become a friend with an American, but it's very difficult to have a substantial kind of significant friendship. Whereas in Britain, it's very difficult to make friends because I think once the idea is once you're friends, you have a very substantial kind of friendship. Maybe that's been my experience. And with windsurfing, it took me quite a while to feel comfortable around the people I was windsurfing. And it wasn't until I started going on road trips with a few of them, hanging around them a bit more, that you start to feel that there is something of substance there, and it's just, but it's completely a different thing. We don't share the same kind of humor necessarily, or even the same kind of politics, but there, but there's a different kind of connection, which is also is valuable.
Yeah. And would you consider yourself to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Yes, I guess I'll take the Heideggerian line as looking back is my way of looking forward. And I think my main fault is somewhere around this notion of impatience. Sometimes I can be, or maybe most of the time I'm very impatient, but also as a part of that impatience is I can be so forward oriented in terms of goals that I often miss what's going on in the present, because I'm so, with sports, I get so driven about something I need to accomplish that sometimes I forget a lot of the good things that are happening along the way. And that's just me. That's it.
But Todd, it has been so amazing to catch up with you.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Thank you very much.